Celebration 25. Our years are celebrating. So keep communicating with KABC Talk Radio 79.
25 years of exploring new worlds, new ideas, and new people. Years of entertaining conversation, stimulating information. Join the Celebration 25 with
Bill Jenkins.
Welcome in to a Saturday night. That's what it is. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind, and for the next 3 hours, we want to stretch yours a little bit. Open it a little bit, and you may need to have one to stay with us, because tonight, our subject is an old friend, an old topic, and there may be some skeptics out there. We want you skeptics, turn your radio up loud. This is your night. We're going to talk about UFOs. And one of the gentlemen who is going to join us to talk about UFOs tonight is a newcomer to Open Mind, and we're very, very delighted to have him aboard. His name is John D. Herrera. John, welcome.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
Why am I talking to you about UFOs tonight?
Why? I don't know. Maybe you're interested in the skeptic debunking I do. That's part of my work.
Well, that certainly caught my attention. John, you're a part of MUFON and APRO. You are into the UFOs. You have a technical background. You have, you're a technical writer. I don't think that you want the wool pulled over your eyes. I don't think that you want to go around believing in a myth, as it were.
No, I don't.
And what caught my attention is that you were looking upon the work of Randy and the Skeptics as rather a mythical enterprise that they're involved in, and you want to challenge them.
That's right. Guys like Randy misrepresent what they really stand for. Their sales pitch sounds very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really look into the backgrounds, what they really stand for, it's horrifying.
Well, let's remember that the word skeptics is a derivative of the Greek town of Skeptos, which was the city of ignorance.
Pyro, if I remember right, was the original skeptic. And then later on in the modern philosophy, there was David Hume, who also fought a lot with the religious people of his time.
Yeah.
17th century.
Well, you always, whenever you're on a forefront of thought, you're going to run into this. Now, I don't want to put the skeptics down altogether. I think healthy skepticism is a very, very important process of education.
Yes, it is.
And without it, you know, we could run amok. You know, our imaginations could just take us into all different directions. So we need to keep our feet on the ground. But at the same time, skepticism that is in itself run amok.
Right, absolutely.
Stops the advancement of mankind and the understanding of the world that we live in and the realities.
Right, they throw obstacles in our way.
For reasons of ego, usually more than
right,
anything else.
Right, definitely.
But let me ask you a few questions. Now, you have been involved in the research of UFOs for some time. Is there such a thing as a UFO?
Yes, they're very real. And that's what I've been trying to tell people. The Herald Examiner offered a $10,000 prize recently for evidence, show evidence of a UFO encounter. And I thought, great, this is my chance to get some of my new information out.
All right.
So I accepted this challenge and discussed it with Al Seckel, and we agreed on the preliminaries. And then I found out that the money was really from Randy, and I was supposed to contact him and make arrangements. And knowing Randy, I knew there was no hope of ever...
You know, I've never had the opportunity to meet Randy, but I have had an opportunity to meet a number of people who are involved in... there are psychics, for instance. There are people who can walk on hot coals, which
right.
I do. There are people in the UFO investigation. I mean, you're looking now at classified government documents. We have the government of the United States saying that there are UFOs.
Right.
And they didn't like to give up that information, but out of the Freedom of Information Act, they had to.
Really.
The government has had.
The CIA.
Had
FBI
to admit that there are UFOs.
A lot of documents.
But then we find that When you start confronting these people with this level of information, they do things like this letter you have here that you sent to Randy and
right.
was refused.
Randy's last letter
had been opened and sent back to you, refused.
Randy's last letter, he warned me that part of the agreement that's in his book, Flim Flam, that I was to send a self-addressed stamped envelope, that his last two letters... He had to pay the postage, valued him 44 cents. That if I would send that to him, he would reply to my request for the $10,000 challenge and proceed.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I sent him his 44 cents and a letter, a nice lengthy letter. And this is what I got back. Refused.
I refused an open letter.
But he didn't refuse it. He actually steamed the letter open, did a sloppy job. You can see all the seams are coming apart. Put a little bit of glue on the top flap. And
he didn't want to get up his $10,000 because
no.
Randy has had to have seen by now the documents that are flowing out of the
He's
government.
He's afraid that...
Certainly the documents that have come out of the incident in the recent incident in England and the one in northern New York around
right.
Brewster, New York.
He knows I'm serious about this thing.
Yeah.
I've been around a while.
So the skeptics are on notice. Any time that Randy or any of the skeptic group want to get together with these microphones
right.
and do their thing with... the UFO people who can do their
I'd
thing.
I'd like to meet this guy. I know his tricks.
The birds in May. I may have to shuffle somebody around.
He's not going
to
fool me one bit.
Put him on there. Well, what's some of the new information that you have about the UFOs, the reality of the UFO? John, we want to talk about that, and I know that the audience will want to talk to you about what they have seen, what they want to know about.
Right. There are so many people out there that have seen UFOs, and that's where the heaviest evidence really is when you get... You talk to someone who's seen a UFO up close. I'm talking 100 feet, 200 feet,
mm-hmm.
and when there's more than one witness. All of these documentaries and books are just full of lights in the sky a great distance away, and there's no need to fool around with that kind of... when we have so many good sightings.
Well, this is one of the things that we talk about here, because I agree with you, and just from the people I've talked to, the calls that come in when we talk about UFOs in this show, a lot of people have seen a lot of lights.
Right.
And the lights are rather dramatic, and there's something to see, lights in the sky that are doing things that they're not supposed to be. I've seen that once, where
mm-hmm.
I thought it was a satellite coming over, and then all at once it stopped and did a 90-degree turn to the left, and then a 90-degree turn to the right.
Don't do that.
And in fact, we sat out, my whole family and a lot of our friends, and watched this cavorting around in the sky. Balloons don't do that. For, I guess, about an hour and a half, and then all at once it kind of locked into position with one of the constellations, and then just floated off into, the nighttime sky.
We get a lot of those.
But, all you can see is a light. There are so many more fascinating contacts that people have had where you can see the ship itself. You can see the lights in the ship. You can see maybe it landing or hovering or doing other strange things. And, of course, others have gone on and had other encounters, which are quite fascinating in themselves. How deeply involved are you, and why did you get into the UFO phenomenon?
Well, that's a long story, and I've...
Make it short.
I guess I could...
Make it short and tell us about it.
Be brief.
Well, before
I'm
you do...
a youngster.
Before you do that, I'm going to have to do something that I'll have to do from time to time
sure.
throughout the course of the evening. And that's pause for a minute, take a sip of coffee, sell you something. It's Open Mind. John D. Herrera is with me. John is with APRO and MUFON, which is a UFO investigative organization, and two very, very fine ones. He has a lot of information, and you'll have a chance to talk to John in just a few minutes about the reality of the UFO. And we want to talk to you about the UFO, any of the questions that you may have about it. Speaking of that, let me have that little computer readout I gave you a second there, John, about what's coming up, because we're going to continue this next week in a very different fashion. We'll talk about the UFOs as they are existing right now and the latest information on them and what we have found out. But next week in studio will be author and researcher Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah has written two really formidable books in the past. One of them is called The Twelfth Planet, the other one Stairway to Heaven. And his newest book is called The Wars of Gods and Men. Now, Zachariah's research deals with the ancient records of the Sumerians and the writings out of Mesopotamia and Babylonia. And what we see is that there were some very early science fiction writers back there, or they were making some very accurate observations about what was going on in their world, about the intervention into Earth life of alien beings. And as Zechariah will point out in his new book, The Wars of Gods and Men, that the first nuclear war on this planet occurred 2002 B.C., and that comes out of the ancient record, and we'll discover how the area of Mesopotamia and Babylonia was devastated by that, and, by the way, still is as of today. It's just arid wasteland, and it was a nuclear blast that happened back there, a nuclear war. So I invite you to join me next week for that. On July 27th, one of the most important shows of the year will occur here as Thomas E. Bearden joins me again. Thomas is leading America's effort in the research into Soviet weather control. And it is now the contention of a large group of scientists, and we'll go into that with you, that the United States is engaged in an undeclared war with the Soviet Union, and the weapons is weather. And the weather that we've been experiencing this last week, I think you will find out, was engineered by the Soviet Union. The weather we experienced last December and January here in Southern California, across New Mexico, Arizona, into Texas, and on up the Adirondack chain where they had record low temperatures, was engineered by the Soviet Union. That only killed 430 people. And we lost the corn crop the year before because of Soviet weather engineering. Half the corn crop. And they were just playing around. I invite you to join me on the 27th of July for Thomas Bearden. We'll show you exactly how that's done, the science behind it, and why it is something we do need to pay attention to. I think that perhaps we can add three more to the list of casualties in this undeclared war as of the events here in Los Angeles in the last week. On August 3rd, Dr. Philip Berg will be with me. He is the world's leading expert, I guess, on the Kabbalah, the Jewish oral history. And the Kabbalah has many fascinating things to tell you about the reality of the UFO, reincarnation, out of body, and all of those other things, which was a part of the Jewish mysticism. And Dr. Berg and you and I will have a chance to go into that. We'll get into the out-of-body experience on October 24th with Robert Monroe of the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences. He will be here. On August 7th, Thomas Jacobson, one of the finest transmediums you'll ever have a chance to talk to, will be here. And also Dr. Peoples, who works through Thomas, will kind of interact with you. A little bit later, on September 14th, Dr. Russell Targ and Keith Harari, who were so very, very instrumental in the research that went on at the Stanford Research Institute concerning the development of ESP and
remote viewing
particularly. And the authors of The Mind Race will be our guest, and they have a handheld electronic device that was developed for NASA to train you in developing your ESP and remote viewing skills. You'll have a chance to talk to them about that. So we have quite an exciting summer coming up here on Open Mind. But right now we have John D. Herrera, and we're talking UFOs. How'd you get into the UFO study, John?
Well, I've always been interested in anything that's scientific or technical, and I read a lot. And my mother had seen something when she was about 13 years of age, looking out the window of Grandfather's ranch. She saw this glowing object come down, land near the ranch. So she told me about that, and my grandmother had related some other stories. And I knew they were serious, yet I couldn't believe it was anything supernatural. So I've been attempting ever since to find answers to these UFOs and ghosts and what have you.
Have you found it?
Yes, I think I have. I was fortunate enough to see a UFO myself.
How close?
In 1956. Well, it was less than 100 feet. It was daylight, and there were probably 18 other people there.
Where was it?
My younger brother and I had a paper route outside of Alamosa, Colorado, the home of Snippy and a lot of UFO stories. Well, anyhow, we were delivering newspapers. It was still light. We came on to Highway 160, headed towards Blank and Fort Garland. And about 300 yards ahead of us, there was some tall trees in the farmhouse. We saw this object come around the trees and towards us on the left side of the highway. And then it shot upward into the sky and as it came alongside our pickup. Then it turned and crossed the highway directly over the top of our pickup. So it must have been maybe at the closest point, 50 feet in distance. And we got a pretty good look at it. I was trying to avoid running into the other cars I was driving, so my brother got a much better look than I did. And it was rather embarrassing to say that this thing was egg-shaped. Didn't have any windows or airfoils. Just plain egg-shaped.
Just kind of worked off different principles.
I just wished it would have had a canopy and aliens looking out, but I've got to be truthful about it, and that's all I saw. But as it shot up into the sky, there was what appeared to be a flame coming out of the back of it.
It did have a flame.
So there was some kind of propulsion, ionic maybe.
Who knows?
Who knows?
It's really kind of dumb, I think, for us to try to apply our science to the science of someone who's able to get a craft here from wherever they come from.
Right.
As if our little planet Earth here is the citadel of all knowledge for the universe.
With that experience, I was a confirmed believer, you might say, in UFOs. So all I had to do was find out what they were, not to convince myself that they were real.
In your work with MUFON and with APRO, which are two of the finest organizations, and again, you're not interested in chaff, and you're not interested in propagating a myth. You're interested in raw data, hard facts. What are some of the more outstanding things that you've come across in those investigations?
Well, my specialty is the balls of light, intelligent balls of light that are associated with UFOs. And I find that these will come into homes late at night. And
what are they?
Well, scientists keep talking about these plasma balls and ball lightning and what have you. And maybe there's two kinds, I don't know. But these things seem to have an intelligence.
There's a natural kind of ball lightning that happens.
Right, absolutely.
There are 1,800 different points on the Earth that will produce those at any given time.
Let me tell you a short story about a man in Van Nuys is sitting in his living room watching television. It's about 10 o'clock in the evening, and his window is slightly open, and he looks over the corner of his eye, and he sees this ball of light drop out of the sky, come through that opening in the window, circle around his room, as it right at the same altitude as the posters he's got, Star Wars posters and all that, and goes along the television, and when it goes by the chair he's sitting in, it pauses for a minute. And goes around the chair, then shoots back towards the open window and goes back out. So if that's some ball lightning, maybe so.
That's not natural ball lightning. No.
But then you take other cases where these balls of light have taken human form and spoken to people, and that kind of shoots down the ball lightning theory.
Not a natural thing.
No, not at all. In Zaytun, Egypt, in 1968, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people that saw some of these balls of light and got as close as 8 feet to some of these. And good photographs.
Were they hot, the balls?
Well, no, they didn't report any heat sensations, but they got some good photographs.
You have those photographs?
Not with me, but I can sure
you can sure bring
show them to anyone.
Anybody that wants to see them.
And I'm surprised there wasn't a lot of publicity on this.
You know, I have found that the best interrogators in the world are the people who listen to this program. They ask much better questions than I do. And I'll ask questions along the evening, but I want to give our audience a chance to talk to you, John, an investigator from MUFON and APRO. You're a technical writer in the aerospace industry. You understand a lot of the science that is involved. And certainly, I think you're able to see that whenever a lot of these things are doing things that defy our conventional view of physics and how the world operates, of course, we're finding out that we don't know about that, that there are a lot of mistakes in our electromagnetic theory. In fact, the conventional electromagnetic theory is on the shelf now. It doesn't really operate the way most people think it does. Let me give you the telephone numbers if you'd like to get in, and we'd like to talk UFOs with you tonight. Welcome aboard.
Well, hello there. I had a couple thoughts about UFOs that I wanted to relate and see if the hypothesis which emerges from this makes any sense to your guest. It seems to me UFOs are rather good at avoiding the kind of, well, plentiful documentation that we see with things like, oh, tornadoes, and there's even a number of films that exist of meteors, fireballs going through the atmosphere and such, and yet there's hardly anything of any real quality in a motion picture film, and little besides ambiguously, you know, tiny objects on film as far as still photographs are concerned. Anyway, I think the point is that...
Not exactly correct, Don, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm talking about, you know, plentiful, comfortably unambiguous evidence photographically, but they tend to avoid places where there are huge numbers of people with cameras and observatories and such.
I don't know. They've been to places where there were 10,000 people taking 10,000 pictures of them, particularly in Rome is one of the places that I remember in the last couple of years where thousands of people.
Yes, please tell us who's out there at night with a camera trying to photograph these.
Well, there are a lot of amateur astronomers, for instance, and all-night cameras at the Prairie Network that photograph meteor trails all night long, every night.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to avoid being within the point of view of places like that which are steady places that have for decades have been doing this. The point is, it's almost as if there's a intelligence directing these that... as if people have access to the historical record and they're able to avoid places where they can be documented by all the official sky documentation centers that exist. My point is that I think that the UFOs are, they are a physical manifestation of advanced means that we will have one day in the future of looking back into the past. And the movements you describe as far as intelligent movements of a bright object in the sky is like a discontinuity in our reality caused by these looking devices of people in the future as they move their point of view from one place to another. That way they could appear to zip around and apparently defy laws of angular momentum and such, although in reality it's just like as if you take a telescope and you're looking at one part of the moon and then the other and you can zip around, your viewpoint can zigzag and possibly fast, but just a matter of how you adjust your little, you know, your telescope. Now, it's a minority theory that UFOs may come from the future, but I think that it satisfies the requirements, including the fact that the beings usually look somewhat humanoid, while in reality you'd probably expect more random reshuffling of genetic parameters that end up making an alien form in a very alien planet. So we're seeing ourselves in the future looking back at us because they're curious about us.
That probably, they've learned enough about us not to get around us too much. I mean, we're talking about getting into a snake pit here. Would you deliberately go down among this group?
Right, they are intelligent, much more so than, say, animals and so forth. They avoid us. Occasionally you're popping up and scaring the heck out of someone.
Well,
they don't last long enough to...
When we have a philosophy, if we don't understand it, we kill it. You know, you don't want to get around.
No, you see, they don't interact physically with us in real sense. They just look at us like they look like little more than
that's
a will-o'-the-wisp in the air. But in actuality, you see, time travel and such, physical laws dictate against physical interaction between time because you get into paradoxes and such. But
you know, I hear you use some terms here, Don, called physical laws, as if the laws of physics that you're dealing with there were fingered by God on some stone on Mount Sinai and brought down. Those are not physical laws. That is just the sum total of some of the observation that some of our learned men have made, and we're finding out that those things are not laws at all, but they were incorrect hypotheses.
Well, we're talking about logic. You know what I'm talking about. Like if you go back into the past and kill your mother before she conceives you and that sort of stuff. That's logic more than...
You saw that movie, didn't
you? We all tuned in last night for the time.
Really? Well, do you see any
yes, that's
validity.
A possibility.
In the possibility the UFOs are from the future.
We can't rule that out, no.
Absolutely not. We already can in the laboratory, and we have seen we can bend space-time. And, in fact, we're using that now in some of the weapon systems that are being developed here in the United States and have been developed in the Soviet Union. So bending space-time is not a physical impossibility. It is
No, that's a proven fact.
That's a proven fact, and it does happen. And we actually do it all the time. We just are not aware of the fact how we've been space-time.
We've projected our religious, you know, perimeters in an expanding sense that a lot of people now, it's outer space. And so the things that used to be angels and poltergeist are now things from outer space. But in reality, it's whatever it is that at the fringe of our belief system. And I think that the popularity of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, let's not forget, the first UFO classical flying saucer shape appeared in the covers of Astounding Science Fiction in the 1920s.
No, actually, the first flying saucer descriptions appeared in the ancient Sumerian records and
back
in the Bible.
I'm talking about an image of that word, you know, of the type that we have, the first pictorial representation that we have.
I think you'll find it in the pyramids.
Okay, but I'm just saying that the science fiction literature has colored our impression of what the limits of our consciousness are, and that's tended to color our interpretation of what these unknowns are. We sort of project part of our spiritual thirst for the ultimate
there. I think that's very true in effect,
in
what you're
sense,
saying.
My mother saw a UFO long before that, and
no
effect whatsoever on that.
Sure,
granted.
You know, there was quite a phenomenon here that happened about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago. It was called the great spaceship thing, and it floated from Sacramento all the way up to Chicago.
Indeed, they saw airships back
then. And it looked kind of like a Jules Verne ship. Now, that's just what the consciousness of the people, they couldn't fathom anything else other than that back in the mid-1800s, and so that was the way the description of it came out.
That's exactly what I mean.
But it was seen by, you know, tens of thousands of people.
That shows how literature and illustrations of the time tend to color people's projections of what, mm-hmm. what may not quite be real. Reality we're familiar with suddenly appears, and we tend to sort of color it with what we.
But now we have photographs.
Things should be
there.
But these photographs are no good. You don't see very many really good photographs.
I don't know where you've been.
I haven't seen any really unambiguous photographs that couldn't be faked.
Well, I'm going to have to put a display up here one of these days.
Well, a lot of these UFOs are halfway between a energy and a physical state, a plasma, and. They're very hard to photograph. They're very fuzzy. You can't get beyond that. There's
indeed,
no way you can get it.
The hypothesis that I mentioned would tend to make them not very photogenic, as you describe it. I just tend to think that should be a direction that people should start making an effort to carry cameras with them and
they should,
sort of not tell people so that the future is deprived of the knowledge of where you're going to be. You might be able to sneak up on them that way.
I appreciate your call, Don. And by the way, you're right on target with a lot of the hypothesis of many of the physicists that are working on this case, that we are looking at a form of space travel and interdimensional type of apparatus, which is very difficult for us to understand all of that. But we can see them fading in and out of this dimension at times. In fact, we have a series of photographs that shows them fading right in and out of where we are.
Well, the people in the future are going to outnumber the past, those of the present, just like we do of the past. So there's going to be a lot of people someday who will be historians, and they'll be curious to look back into the past, and I'm sure that they're looking over at dinosaurs and at the molten lavas of a billion years ago. But now, right now, we're probably, it won't be too long until we'll invent those things, we'll invent that means. And when we do, then there'll be a very different world then. I think that there are implications to this hypothesis that are very, very fruitful. And we've seen a lot of metaphysical nonsense about UFOs and space people and spaceships that has tended to make UFO study a little bit less than respectable in many
right,
accounts.
Definitely.
So I think that, you know, it's kind of a stagnant way to go of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and it needs some new life in the subject.
Well, I appreciate your input.
I think
you're on a good one there, Don. Thank you very much for that. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're talking different and perhaps better dynamics into this matter of the UFO. We have another Don on the line. Don, number two, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah.
Hi, John. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank
good.
You.
I have a couple of things to relate to you that you might be interested in. In this month's issue, the July issue of Modern Photography, they have a short article in there about a Norwegian young man who was out working outside of his house, and he saw a UFO, and he ran back in, and the only thing he had available was a little Kodak disc camera, one of the new ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he ran out there, and he got a couple of shots of it and everything. But a Norwegian newspaper did a major article on that, a two-page spread, along with the pictures on the front page. And the Norwegian Air Force examined the little diskette and said there wasn't any tampering of any type with the little exposures. And so they put their stamp of approval that it was authentic. But then the diskette has been forwarded on to NASA.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
That'll be the end of it.
Well, when exactly this occurred, they didn't state, because they just put it in modern photography because it happened to bring up the cameras, see? And the sales of little Kodak disc cameras over in Norway went up after that.
Good.
The only way he'll get that diskette back is through the Freedom of Information Act, and they'll have it tacked to that somewhere. Meanwhile, there'll be another report saying that it was nothing.
Yeah, I've seen
that happen too many times.
I wanted to bring up, you had a guest on a few years ago, Bill, that it was because of that guest. He was talking about UFOs, and I don't recall who it was, whether it was Hynek or maybe even the Gladdens. But it recalled an event that occurred many years ago when I was 15 years old, back in 1952. And I had completely forgotten it until your guest was on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was headed for New York on a Greyhound bus. I got on at L.A. here. And I had a young man sitting next to me. I was 15. He must have been about 22 or 23 years old. And clean-cut looking kid. He was on his way back to Ohio. And he was on leave, but he was wearing civilian clothes. So we did a little chit-chatting back and forth and whatnot, and I told him things that were interesting to me at 15, and he talked about different things. But somehow we got on the subject of astronomy and other things, and I happened to ask him somewhere along the line, what did he think about these flying saucers, see?
They were getting to be very big then.
Yeah, so we bantered it back and forth, see, but then he said, there's something, he said, I can tell you. He said, but it would freak you out. And I'd come back to that every once in a while in the conversation.
What'd they tell you that freaked you out?
He wouldn't. He wouldn't tell me. He'd get very agitated, very solemn. But he was stationed at a base in Ohio. And if I remember correctly, that's back there where that Hangar 18 was at.
Sounds like it might have been right there.
He might have known something.
He was an MP there. See, but I kept pressing on that. And he would get agitated, but he wouldn't tell me. He would just say, there's something I can tell you, but it would just freak you out. And I never found out what
do you have his
meant
name?
By that. But when we hit, ordinarily, when we hit...
John, do you happen to have that guy's name? I imagine.
No, I sure don't. I'll tell you this, Bill. I'm going to finish this up here. Ordinarily, we would have transferred and gone our separate ways at Chicago. I'd have gone on to New York, and he'd have transferred over to a bus for Ohio. But we hit a stopover at Kansas City and got off for a rest stop. We got back on. He wasn't on that bus.
Hmm.
I mean, I was used to talking to this guy all the way. And all of a sudden, he's not on the bus at Kansas City. He didn't get back on. That seat was empty.
Well, that was a very unusual time in the early 50s.
It was, see? And there weren't any cults or anything else back in those days. And there wasn't a lot of information around about it. But I had that curiosity, but I just kept probing at him. Every once in a while, I didn't bear down too hard, but I looped the conversation back. But he would come to that same point. I'd like to tell you, but I cannot tell you. But he'd say it would freak you out.
During that period, the late 40s to the early 50s, Wright-Patman Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base, that was the center of all UFO studies that the government was engaged in at that time.
All right. Well,
it's now been extended to all over. But,
the thing I'm thinking now, Bill, is if this fella is out there now and he hears this show, he could prove that he was on that bus with me, because only he knows the months that he was on that bus, that I was on there with him. That's the one thing. He could call in and say, hey, I was on that bus with
a
young fellow, and it was this month and this week.
Well, if you were on the bus, guy.
If you ever get a chance to contact him, I'd sure like to hear from him.
I'd like to have him call into the show if he's listening to this.
1952.
Hey, now you know what I couldn't tell you.
All right.
That's the year the CIA had their meeting and decided to ridicule UFO reports.
Right.
Most people don't know about that.
I didn't remember that, Bill, until you had somebody on there, and I never put the pieces together.
That sounds like I may have had Bill Moore on at the time.
And that whole thing came back to me.
All right.
I mean, that was 1952 when I was 15, and now I'm 48, and all of a sudden, you know, a couple of years ago, it came right back up to me. This is what this young fellow was trying to tell me, but he couldn't. Yeah.
He may have very well had the skinny on something there. Don, thank you very much for your call.
Bill.
Appreciate that very much.
Okay, take care.
I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking UFOs tonight with John D. Herrera. Listen, Tony, you want some hard evidence? What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. Hi, fellas. My questions for your guests are these. Number one, I'd like to know what his process of verification is. For for example, with the Van Nuys man who claimed that he saw this this intelligent ball of light, I mean, the man reports that. Do you simply take his word for that?
No, absolutely not. There's so many other cases, though. I read everything I can find on that subject. The technical libraries are full of cases such as that.
People that have reported that particular kind of incident.
Right.
Okay. And the other thing is, do you contend that a big city newspaper reporter has either never seen one of these UFOs or has had the story squashed by his editor?
What are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that why in the world don't we, let's take a guy like Jack Nelson from the LA Times, or really any reporter.